Hi, this is Tony Bruschi. You're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia. Being a brand new show, we need to let other folks know that this thing exists so we can keep doing it. I'd greatly appreciate your help in that effort by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and I'm going to make it worth your while as well. We're going to give away a $200 Amazon gift certificate to one person who left us a review. All you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, and then send it to me. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com. So, again, to review, leave the review at Apple Podcasts, take the screenshot, and then send it to me. review@darksideofwiki.com. That's the email address. review@darksideofwiki.com. Very soon, I'll select one person to get that $200 Amazon gift card as a thank you for leaving that review and letting other folks know we exist. Also, be sure to share us on social media, let your friends and family know, and be sure to press that subscribe button as well as we get another great podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoy The Dark Side of Wikipedia. For nearly two decades, a killer known only as BTK would terrorize Wichita, Kansas, causing neighbors to question neighbors, friends to suspect the worst in those they trusted, and would create an atmosphere of fear as citizens wondered who would be the next victim and why. Then the mysterious killer would disappear, re-emerging nearly 15 years later. Would he strike again?
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Dennis Lynn Rader is an American serial killer known simply as BTK, or the BTK Strangler. Rader gave himself the name BTK for bind, torture, kill between 1974 and 1991. Rader killed 10 people in Wichita, Kansas metro area. Rader sent taunting letters to police and newspapers describing the details of his crimes. After a decade-long hiatus, Rader resumed sending letters in 2004, leading to his 2005 arrest and subsequent guilty plea. He's serving 10 consecutive life sentences at the El Dorado Correctional Facility in Kansas. And that's where we begin our story today. A look at the dark side of Wikipedia and the entry on the BTK killer, Dennis Rader. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you for this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. What's interesting about this episode, Carol, you have spent a majority of your life there in Wichita.
Yes.
While these events unfolded. So it's going to be really interesting to hear your perspective on this whole thing. And you've been in the media for a good chunk of it as well. So I'm excited to kind of dig into this story.
And to put it in perspective, where I live, as a bird flies, I'm maybe a half a mile from the house that he killed the members of the family in, the Otero family.
Yeah.
So I live really close. I drive by that house like every other day, probably.
And it's a family home still, correct? Somebody lives in it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. When it was for sale a couple years ago, they put up like this hand-painted sign in the front. Only serious people, no gawkers. So obviously when they opened it up trying to sell it, people were going in there just to look at it.
And that's good. Yeah.
As people do, you know.
It's
It's creepy. It was really creepy when I first realized that was the house years ago.
I can't say that I never, out of curiosity when living there, did not go and drive by some remnant of this case. The thing I drove by and knew what was his or where his home once stood in Park City, Kansas, which actually I had a house in Park City for a short period of time. It wasn't in his neighborhood, but I went and drove by that area, and it's now just it's an empty lot. They tore that house down.
Yeah, because of that, people driving by all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that was the right thing to do, was to tear down the house.
Which is interesting, because as far as we know, there were no murders that actually took place on his property, but that's where he lived. That's where this, you know, sick man spent his nights, you know, thinking about these things and plotting these things up.
So yeah, and he had this creepy kind of building out back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a shed or something that he turned into, like, his, lack of a better term, his equivalent of a man cave.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, and that's where he kept a lot of things.
It was like his trophy room?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm not saying trophy room in a light way, but I mean, that's essentially what serial killers have. They have their
He did keep things from every victim.
Yeah, they have these trophies or whatever you want to call them.
They're driver's license.
God, that's... it's creepy. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I never got out of my car there to look other than driving by, but I'm sure you walk by there and there's probably, you know, remnants of where that shed was. And that's just, yeah, it was a creepy thing, no matter what, any way you spin it.
But the creepiest thing about him was he lived in the community and nobody ever guessed it was him.
Yeah.
And my veterinarian was in Park City,
mm-hmm.
and it was right across the street from where he worked.
And which,
you know, he was a dog catcher, and I'm sure I ran into him. Then one time my dog ends up poisoned and somebody tries to break in my house that night. Not saying it was him, but it was super creepy.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like I'd been at the vet like that day or a couple days before, and then my dog gets really sick and I had to rush her back to the vet, and I'm like, you know, she got really sick, and then somebody tried to break my house last night. A man, I saw him, and because I was home,
mm-hmm.
and because I couldn't sleep because my dog's so sick. And I said, "Do you think that that person could have poisoned my dog?"
Mm-hmm.
And the vet's like, "Absolutely, it definitely could have been." So I don't know, but he fit into the community so well, like,
yeah. And that's what we're going to...
friends that went to church with him.
We're going to dig into his whole story. And that's an interesting thing about this case is so many people have a run-in or have a related story of how they somehow cross paths with him over time.
And he could be a big asshole.
Yeah. And so we'll talk about some of that as we continue into the story. Let's get into how everything began. This is how the story of Dennis Rader begins. He was born on March 9th, 1945, to Dorothea May Rader and William Elvin Rader. He's one of four sons. His brothers are named Paul, Bill, and Jeff. Though born in Pittsburgh, Kansas, he grew up in Wichita. His parents both worked long hours and paid little attention to their children at home. He would later describe feeling ignored by his mother in particular and resenting her for it. From a very young age, Rader harbored sadistic sexual fantasies about torturing, trapped, and helpless women. He also exhibited pseudosadism by torturing, killing, and hanging small animals. He acted out sexual fetishes for voyeurism, autoerotic asphyxiation, and cross-dressing. He'd often spy on female neighbors while dressed in women's clothing, including women's underwear that he had stolen, and masturbate with ropes or other bindings around his arms and neck. Years later, during his cooling-off periods between murders, he would take pictures of himself wearing women's clothes and a female mask while bound. He'd later admit that he was pretending to be his victims as part of his sexual fantasy. He kept his sexual proclivities well hidden. However, he was widely regarded in his community as friendly and polite. Rader attended Kansas Wesleyan University after high school, but received mediocre grades and dropped out after 1 year. He spent 1966 to 1970 in the United States Air Force. Upon discharge, he moved to Park City, Kansas, where he worked in the meat department of a Leaker's IGA supermarket, where his mother was a bookkeeper. He married Paula Dietz on May 22, 1971, and they had two children, Carrie and Ryan. He attended Butler Community College in El Dorado, earning an associate's degree in electronics in 1973. He then enrolled at Wichita State University and graduated in 1979 with a bachelor's degree in administration of justice. Rader worked as an assembler for the Coleman Company, an outdoor supply company. He worked at the Wichita-based office of ADT Security Services from 1974 to 1988, where he installed security alarms as part of his job, in many cases for homeowners concerned about the BTK killings. Rader was a census field operations supervisor for the Wichita area in 1989, before the 1990 federal census. In May 1991, he became a dog catcher and compliance officer in Park City. In this position, neighbors recalled him as being sometimes overzealous and extremely strict, as well as taking special pleasure in bullying and harassing single women. One neighbor complained he killed her dog for no reason. Rader was a member of Christ Lutheran Church and had been elected president of the church council. He was also a Cub Scout leader. On July 26, 2005, after Rader's arrest, his wife was granted an emergency divorce, waiving the normal waiting period. That's how the story of Dennis Rader begins. There you go, killing a dog for no apparent reason. That's creepy. Does it? How does this make you feel, kind of hearing these stories and these details again on this case all these years later? Because, I mean, it's been out of the spotlight.
I've heard frequently.
Sure.
So it's kind of living here for as long as I have. It's something that most of us, especially because, like, I do work in the media. Mm-hmm. And so we've heard the stories.
So many times.
But it pisses me off every time I hear them.
Sure.
I'm like, that son of a bitch.
It's especially creepy when you have a case and you can hear the story and then you can picture half of the stuff that is being talked about. This is my first time going through this in great detail, other than when I pulled the entry. But I didn't know that he worked at the Leakers grocery store, which actually, when I worked in radio, I would go to that Leakers almost every day and go and have a salad from their salad bar and sit in my truck and eat it. I was a frequent customer of that grocery store, and I didn't know that he had worked there. Like, that's a new little connection I just learned about as reading this. But yeah, it's creepy to hear everything about this case. Let's continue on with more of the story of Dennis Rader. On January 15, 1974, four members of the Otero family were murdered in Wichita, Kansas. The victims were Joseph Otero, age 38, Julie Otero, age 33, and two children, Joseph Otero Jr., age 9, and Josephine Otero, age 11. Their bodies were discovered by the family's eldest child, Charlie Otero, who was in 10th grade at the time, as he returned home from school. After his 2005 arrest, Rader confessed to killing the Otero family. Rader wrote a letter that had been stashed inside an engineering book in the Wichita Public Library in October 1974, which described in detail the killing of the Otero family in January of that year. In early 1978, he sent another letter to television station Cake in Wichita, claiming responsibility for the murders of the Oteros. Catherine Bright, Shirley Vine, and Nancy Fox. He suggested many possible names for himself, including the one that stuck, BTK. He demanded media attention in the second letter, and it was finally announced that Wichita did indeed have a serial killer at large. A poem was enclosed titled, "Oh, Death to Nancy," a parody of the lyrics to the American folk song, "Oh, Death." In the letter, he claimed to be driven to kill by Factor X, which he characterized as a supernatural element that also motivated the Jack the Ripper, Son of Sam, and Hillside Strangler murderers. He also intended to kill others, such as Anna Williams, who in 1979, age 63, escaped death by returning home much later than expected. Ritter explained during his confession that he became obsessed with Williams and was absolutely livid when she evaded him. He spent hours waiting at her home, but became impatient and left when she did not return home from visiting friends. Marianne Hedge, age 53, was found on May 5, 1985 at East 53rd Street North in between North Webb Road and North Greenwich Road in Wichita. Rader had killed her on April 27, 1985, and he took her dead body to his church, the Christ Lutheran Church, where he was the president of the church council. There, he photographed her body in various bondage positions. Rader had previously stored black plastic sheets and other materials at the church in preparation for the murder, and then later dumped the body in a remote ditch. He called his plan Project Cookie. In 1988, after the murders of three members of the Fager family in Wichita, a letter was received from someone claiming to be the BTK killer, in which the author of the letter denied being the perpetrator of the Fager murders. The author credited the killer with having done admirable work. It was not proven until 2005 that this letter was, in fact, written by Rader. He's not considered by police to have committed this crime. Additionally, two of the women Rader had stalked in the 1980s and one he'd stalked in the mid-1990s had filed restraining orders against him. One of them also moved away. His final victim, Dolores E. Davis, was found on February 1st, 1991 at West 117th Street North and North Meridian Street in Park City. Rader killed her on January 19th, 1991. By 2004, the investigation of the BTK killer was considered a cold case. Then Rader began a series of 11 communications to the local media that led directly to his arrest in February of 2005. In March of 2004, the Wichita Eagle received a letter from someone using the return address Bill Thomas Killman. The author of the letter claimed that he had murdered Vicky Wergel on September 16, 1986, and enclosed photographs of the crime scene and a photocopy of her driver's license, which had been stolen at the time of the crime. Before this, it had not been definitively established that she was killed by BTK. DNA collected from under her fingernails provided police with previously unknown evidence. It then began DNA testing hundreds of men in an effort to find the serial killer. Altogether, over 1,300 DNA samples were taken and later destroyed by court order. In May 2004, television station Cake in Wichita received a letter with a chapter headlining for the BTK story, fake IDs, and a word puzzle. On June 9, 2004, a package was found taped to a stop sign at the corner of 1st and Kansas in Wichita. It had graphic descriptions of the Otero murders and a sketch labeled, "The Sexual Thrill Is My Bill." Also enclosed was a chapter list for a proposed book titled The BTK Story, which mimicked a story written in 1999 by Court TV crime reporter David Lohr. Chapter 1 was titled, "A Serial Killer Is Born." In July, a package was dropped into the return slot at the downtown public library containing more bizarre material, including the claim that he was responsible for the death of 19-year-old Jake Allen in Argonia, Kansas, earlier that month. This claim was false and the death was ruled a suicide. After his capture, Rader admitted in his interrogation that he had been planning to kill again, and he had set a date, October of 2004, and was stalking his intended victim. In October 2004, a manila envelope was dropped in a UPS box in Wichita. It had many cards with images of terror and bondage of children pasted on them. A poem threatening the life of lead investigator Lieutenant Ken Landwehr and a false autobiography with many details about Raider's life. These details were later released to the public. In 2004, in December, Wichita police received another package from the BTK killer. This time the package was found in Wichita's Murdoch Park. It had the driver's license of Nancy Fox, which was noted as stolen from the crime scene, as well as a doll that was symbolically bound at the hands and feet and had a plastic bag tied over its head. In January 2005, Raider attempted to leave a cereal box in the bed of a pickup truck at a Home Depot in Wichita, but the box was discarded by the truck's owner. It was later retrieved from the trash after Raider asked what had become of it in a later message. Surveillance tape of the parking lot from that date revealed a distant figure driving a black Jeep Cherokee, leaving the box in the pickup. In February, more postcards were sent to Cake TV, and another cereal box left at a rural location was found to contain another bound doll, apparently meant to symbolize the murder of 11-year-old Josephine Otero. In his letters to police, Raider asked if his writings, if put on a floppy disk, could be traced or not. The police answered his question in a newspaper ad posted in the Wichita Eagle, stating it would be safe to use the disk. On February 16, 2005, Raider sent a purple 1.44 megabyte Memorex floppy disk to Fox TV affiliate KSAS in Wichita, Kansas. Enclosed were a letter and a gold color necklace with a large medallion and a photocopy of the cover of Rules of Prey, a 1989 novel about a serial killer. Police found metadata embedded in the deleted Microsoft Word document that was unknown to Raider, still stored on the floppy disk. The metadata contained the words Christ Lutheran Church, and the document was marked as last modified by Dennis. An internet search determined that a Dennis Raider was president of the church council. In the Home Depot incident, the police also knew BTK owned a black Jeep Cherokee. When investigators drove by Raider's house, they noticed a black Jeep Cherokee parked outside. The police had strong circumstantial evidence against Raider, but they needed more direct evidence to detain him. They obtained a warrant to test the DNA of a pap smear Raider's daughter had taken at the Kansas State University Medical Clinic when she was a student there. The DNA of the pap smear was processed by the Kansas Bureau of Investigation at their lab in Topeka and demonstrated a familial match to the sample taken from Wergel's fingernails. This indicated that the killer was closely related to Raider's daughter and the evidence the police needed to make an arrest. So a lot of information to unpack there. And before we get into the more current day or the incarnation of him coming back, I want to ask you, what was it like in that city at the time he kind of just disappeared the first time in the early 1990s? What?
Well, he actually had disappeared before then.
Okay.
Because people didn't realize, they had thought he was done killing people. Mm-hmm. So there was a one murder they didn't attribute to him. So okay. They thought he had moved away. He was kind of like an urban myth in okay. a way. I mean, he existed, but then he disappeared. And so they thought maybe he died or something, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of serial murders move around a lot.
Sure.
So that was kind of what people had thought. And I don't know if they made it really clear in what you're reading, but they did like a 25th anniversary story. I think it was 25th in the Wichita Eagle and revisited the whole thing. And that's what got him interested, you know, like, wait, that's me.
Yeah.
And he couldn't let it go because he's this narcissist, ego-driven
sure.
asshole. And so he was like, I don't want you to attribute this to anybody else. Like, I'm still around. And that's what started this whole cat and mouse game again because of that article.
Were there any, to your recollection, between him kind of disappearing and then coming back in the early 2000s, were there any bullshit letters that were sent into places where it's like, is BTK back? But it really turned out to be a hoax of some sort that you remember?
You know, I don't remember that. Not no. saying it didn't happen.
Sure.
I just don't remember that happening.
Yeah.
But I think the way the Wichita Eagle article was written, that he wanted people to know he was still out there.
Mm-hmm.
That it was him who did that. He couldn't let anybody else get away with taking credit. Because as twisted as this sounds, I mean, he's very twisted, but it was almost like a pride thing. He took pride in it.
Yeah.
And like, he used elaborate knots. Like, he was a Boy Scout leader.
Yeah.
Like, one of those, he was out with Boy Scouts in an overnight camping trip, came back. I don't know if he killed her that night and went back out there, or if he had already killed her and took her and hit her. But one of his victims, but he left a camping trip with Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
Like, that's how twisted he was.
When you watch the court case, when they finally, you know, found him guilty and were getting ready to do the sentencing, and then he spoke finally, that is one of the—
Ooh, did he speak?
That was one, like, of the creepiest—
went on for hours, and we aired it live.
Yeah.
On the radio station, and I was on the air, and it's the most disgusting thing ever, because he's very matter of fact.
Yeah.
And very proud of what he did, and this is what he'd been wanting. He wanted the attention and look at me. And I can't remember. He referred to them all as something weird. He didn't say victim. He used another word. I don't remember now. But he dehumanized everyone.
Yeah.
You know, to him, I can't remember what the word is that he uses. But it's— and you, I'm sure, can find it online, the court case. Well, it's no court case. He just got up and confessed to absolutely everything with great pride.
It
was so disgusting.
It's one
it
of
was
the
so sad.
Most chilling confessions I think I've ever seen, where it's like, oh my God. It's just
the,
like,
only thing that I guess was positive is that Lisi's family's got some closure, but it was torturous for them at the same time, because he liked going into great detail on what he did to these people.
Yeah.
And their family members are there. It was so sick.
Yeah. He still sends letters out to media people. I've seen it.
I don't think he can.
I've seen some posted in recent years. Maybe not.
Yeah.
And has that—
I don't think he can.
Has that come to an end?
Yeah. They, like, when he got locked up, he might have for a little bit when he was in the regular prison, but now he's in extreme lockdown prison.
Okay.
In El Dorado, Kansas.
Yeah.
And he can't even have magazines, because he liked that so much, the notoriety, that he just wanted to read about himself.
Okay.
So they shut all that shit down.
Okay.
As they should have.
I've seen, and maybe these are older letters from the transition prison and things, from some Facebook friends who were reporters. Where they had, like, posted, like, here's the letter that Dennis sent me a while, you know, I didn't know what the date was.
Because he'd still be sending letters if he could.
Sure.
He'd be doing that every day.
Yeah.
I'd have one by now. I mean, like.
Exactly.
Anybody who would listen.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing.
Yeah, so I think he was so into reading and hearing about himself that they took away all newspapers and magazines. He doesn't have access to anything like that.
That's good. Let's continue on with this just absolutely chilling story. Rader was arrested while driving near his home in Park City shortly after noon on February 25th, 2005. An officer asked Mr. Rader, "Do you know why you're going downtown?" Rader replied, "Oh, I have suspicions why." Wichita Police, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, and ATF agents searched Rader's home and vehicle, seizing evidence including computer equipment, a pair of black pantyhose retrieved from a shed, and a cylindrical container. The church he attended, his office at City Hall, and the main branch of the Park City Library were also searched. At a press conference the next morning, Wichita Police Chief Norman Williams announced, "The bottom line is BTK is arrested." On February 28, 2005, Ritter was charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder. Soon after his arrest, the Associated Press cited an anonymous source alleging Ritter had confessed to other murders in addition to those with which he had been connected. The Sedgwick County District Attorney denied this, but refused to say whether Ritter made any confessions or if investigators were looking into Ritter's possible involvement in more unsolved killings. On March 5th, news sources claimed to have verified by multiple sources that Ritter had confessed to the 10 murders he was charged with, but no other ones. On March 1st, Ritter's bail was set at $10 million, and a public defender was appointed to represent him. On May 3rd, the judge entered a not guilty plea on Ritter's behalf, as Ritter did not speak at his arraignment. However, on June 27th, the scheduled trial date, Ritter changed his plea to guilty. He described the murders in detail and made no apologies. At Ritter's August 18th sentencing, victims' families made statements, after which Ritter apologized in a rambling 30-minute monologue that the prosecutor likened to an Academy Awards acceptance speech. His statement had been described as an example of an often observed phenomena among psychopaths: their ability to understand the emotional content of language. He was sentenced to 10 consecutive life sentences with a minimum of 175 years. Kansas had no death penalty at the time of the murders. On August 19th, he was moved to the El Dorado Correctional Facility. Ritter talked about innocuous topics such as the weather during a 40-minute drive to El Dorado, but began to cry when the victim's family statements from the court proceedings came on the radio. He's now in solitary confinement for his protection. With 1 hour of exercise per day and showers 3 times per week, this will likely continue indefinitely. Beginning in 2006, he was allowed access to television and radio, to read magazines and other privileges for good behavior. Further investigations. Following Ritter's arrest, police in Wichita, Park City, and several surrounding cities looked into unsolved cases with the cooperation of the state police and the FBI. They particularly focused on cases after 1994, when the death penalty was reinstated in Kansas. Police in surrounding states such as Nebraska, Missouri, Colorado, Oklahoma, and Texas also investigated cold cases that fit Ritter's pattern to some extent. The FBI and local jurisdictions at Ritter's former duty stations checked into unsolved cases during Ritter's time in the service. After exhaustive investigations, none of these agencies discovered any further murders attributable to Ritter, confirming early suspicions that Ritter would have taken credit for any additional murders that he had committed. The 10 known murders are now believed to be the only murders for which Ritter is actually responsible, although Wichita police are fairly certain that Ritter stalked and researched a number of other potential victims. This includes one person who saved the Ritter calls off his planned attack upon his arrival near the target's home due to the presence of construction and road crews nearby. Ritter stated in his police interview that there are a lot of lucky people, meaning that he had thought about and developed various levels of murder plans for other victims. So, how does it feel to know he's probably listening to you every day on the radio?
All right. I never heard that before. You know, because when my dog got poisoned and that whole thing happened, that was like late 80s. Mm-hmm. So he was the dog catcher then. And everybody thought he was dead or had moved away. But that was a super creepy thing. And so when he got arrested and all this shit started coming out, I was like, oh my God, it could have been him.
Yeah.
Like, I'd been at the vet. He worked across the street. He's a dog catcher. My dog gets poisoned, did not die. And I'm not saying that. It's not that it was.
Well, you don't know.
It's so creepy to me.
Yeah.
That whole thing. One thing that he liked this kind of cat and mouse thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that floppy disk that they discovered was from the church. So when they interrogated him, and I know this from our news guy at the time because he'd gone to a press conference with them, mm-hmm. that they only let like six people into, like local people into this press conference.
Mm-hmm.
So when they brought him in for questioning after they'd arrested him, they sat down at this table and they had an identical looking floppy disk and they just set it out on the table. Didn't say any reason why. They just put it out there. And so he sits down and he's like, he's got his finger on the disc, like, you told me this couldn't be traced. You lied to me. Like, he honest to God thought they had this respectful relationship.
Yeah.
And they said, you're a murderer. Yes, we absolutely did lie. And he was offended that they had lied to him. That pissed him off.
It's like they broke the trust between the two of them. Like, they appreciated each other's game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was on the air when he was arrested that day. And a woman I worked with at the time, she and her family went to the same church. It's not a big church.
Mm-hmm.
So her husband was on the counselor, whatever they call it, at their church with him. So the night before, they'd had spaghetti dinner with him.
God.
Like, she's at the spaghetti dinner sitting with him. And at one point, her daughter got up to go get dessert. He's like, hey, could you get me some dessert? She brings it back. And then this whole thing happens. I think her daughter might have been 5, 6, 7 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, but mom, I got him dessert. Because in her head, like, he was this horrible person. And she'd done this nice thing for a horrible person.
Yeah.
And you, how do you explain that to a kid? You know? And so when you think about it, there's so many victims. Like, I felt really bad for his church family and his own family.
Oh, sure.
You know, they didn't know.
No.
Maybe looking back on it, I saw an interview with his daughter. They were all victims.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just so many people that he played. And I still, honest to God, in my heart, I think there's other victims. I don't think he went that long. Now, he might have taken a road trip and, I don't know, could have gone someplace.
Yeah.
But I just, he took so much pride in that and he loved it, the whole thing. And he kept a lot of pictures and stuff. Like, he took Polaroids of these people.
Mm-hmm.
But I just can't imagine someone like him being okay for 20 years with that.
No.
You know? But that whole death penalty thing you were talking about, he admitted to everything, but nothing after that when the death penalty was in effect.
Yeah, then he got real.
You know, his daughter, this is one thing that just pissed me off. And I'll be straight up honest.
Yeah.
Because when I felt very, very, you know, sorry for her and what she's gone through. But at the end of the documentary that I watched with her,
mm-hmm.
she is in communication with him. That's her choice. That's her dad.
Yeah.
But she forgives him. And I couldn't do that.
No.
And he thinks that because he said he asked for forgiveness, then he gets forgiven. I just don't think if there's a heaven and a hell, it works like that. You can do these horrific things and ask for forgiveness and you're okay. You get in. Like, if that's what heaven is like it's that easy to get in. You just say, I'm sorry. Like,
and then you're good.
Yeah.
I don't think that's...
And and as his daughter, I don't know. But honestly, if my father had done that, I could never talk to him again.
No, I mean,
I wouldn't want anything to do with that.
People estrange themselves from families for far less things than that.
I didn't talk to my mom for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Like, It was over a car.
I don't.
And actually, I have more to do than that. But, you know, it's like, if he murdered people, and not only did he do these horrific things, but he lied to his own family.
Yeah.
No.
You know, it's hard to, you know, to criticize that daughter because you don't know. I mean, the psychological damage
right.
that I'm
right.
sure she is.
I have not walked in her shoes.
Yeah.
I get that.
But at the same point, it's like, I get sometimes you have that relationship and you're doing it for yourself because that's what's going to make you heal in some sort of a way. But I'm looking at it from an outside perspective. So this is just my opinion. There's no way in hell I could do that. There's no way I would not be healing by continuing that relationship. The only way I could heal would be to get as far the fuck away from somebody like that as possible. Change my name and start anew.
I think forgiveness is a very odd thing in that. Like, there's certain things, absolutely, I could forgive. People mess up all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to hold that against someone forever. But it's different when it's murder.
Yeah.
Or someone, like, if someone murdered my family member, I can let that, like, you know what? I don't ever want that person in my life again. I'm walking away. But I just don't think I could give them the satisfaction of saying I forgive you. I just... Maybe in my heart, I'm like, I have to move past this in some way, but I wouldn't tell them.
Yeah.
No way.
It's a personal thing, I think.
Yeah.
I'm never going to understand the I'm going to just do this for me, because that's not how I work. I'm very much a, you know, we're good or we're bad or we're okay or
it's time to move up.
I'm
going this way, you go that way.
There's just no use. There's no use. It's not going to benefit either of us, and this is not going to be good. And I'm okay with that. Some are not.
But living in this town that he, you know, and really seeing it firsthand what he did.
Yeah.
And especially like my type of job, because, you know, there was constant news stories and we ran the court hearing or the big confession, whatever you want to call it, because it really wasn't a court. I mean, it was in a court, but he just got up and confessed, which is really kind of unusual. Yeah. There's usually witnesses and stuff.
Yeah.
He just started with victim one and explained just how he did everything. And then seeing those families and what they went through, like, that leaves us just such a really dark imprint on the city and the people who live here and the people. He knew a lot of people.
Sure.
He's the dog catcher, you know, or the compliance officer. And, you know, if people's yard would get too high, he'd be over there screaming at them and threatening them.
Yeah.
So he not only was a serial killer, but he was abusive in his job, which makes me think he was abusive in his own home. And
sure.
You know, he had to been, but he played everybody he knew.
Yeah. So many different roles and hats that he wore. I mean, and in the same note, dog catcher, asshole dog catcher, but then also one of the heads of his church too, you know,
Boy Scout leader.
It's like, what the fuck? I mean, how do you have all these different personas? Well, look how he has all these different personas. He's also fucking killing people left and right. And no, is nobody who's in his own home is all the wiser to it. He, you know, he's a master genius at being a horrible human being. And that's, you know.
And I do feel really sorry for his family, you know, and they moved away immediately. And I don't blame him. And tell his daughter, because she wrote a book, but his ex-wife, she stayed out of it. And I have all the respect for that. You know, because she's a very religious woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you, I don't even know how you make sense of your life. It's like everything you know is a lie.
Yeah.
And that's sad. That's sad.
I don't know how you come out of that when you're that close to...
Right?
Basically, as close as you can get to human evil. It would destroy, you know, most people. And it has destroyed many people.
Yes, exactly.
very interesting conversation on this one, on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia, about Dennis Rader, the BTK killer. Carol, thanks for your insights on this one. It was really interesting.
I hate that son of a bitch. I do.
It's understandable. All right, that's going to wrap up this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, be sure to press subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to us on, and be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, for The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.